Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be talking about in this episode originally shipped on January 21st, 2009. And starting us off in DC is Birds of Prey number 126. This is part of the Faces of Evil stuff. What did you think of this, Bob?
I liked it a lot less than I have historically liked the Birds of Prey series. I can kind of see how, ever since they kind of took away the core team with, you know, Black Canary and Huntress, and, you know, it's, you had Misfit all the time. And they had a really good thing going for a while. And lately, it just hasn't been doing it for me. You know, it's okay. It's just not as good as it once was. I can kind of see them ending the series. I'm not going to be that sorry that they're actually ending it at this point. I would have been if it was, like, getting ended a year ago.
I think I liked it a bit more than you did. I mean, I can see where you're coming from on that. I certainly think taking Black Canary out of the series a while back was, you know, understandable given she's in the Green Arrow Black Canary series, but unfortunate for this title. This issue focused very heavily on Calculator, and I think was a major turning point for that character. And unlike one or two of the other Faces of Evil books, where it's almost felt like they either shanghaied the title to focus on the villain or didn't really focus on the villain they put on the cover much at all, this one, I think, kind of walked the fence really good. It justified the Faces of Evil approach. It certainly was a story about the Calculator, but since the Calculator's been so involved with the Birds of Prey for the last 6 months, a year, or for an extended period of time in this title, it felt natural. It didn't feel like they had shanghaied the title. So I thought the Faces of Evil gimmick worked better here than in some other places, but there are also a couple other Faces of Evil books that I think have been really good too. Now, the change they made to the Calculator this issue I don't think was mandatory, but it was, I thought, kind of cool and certainly kind of makes him more of a legitimate threat than just some guy who's kind of an arrogant know-it-all. And I think this issue really succeeded where that Prometheus issue we talked about last week, for me at least, failed. With Prometheus, they kept telling us, oh, he's a major threat, he's a major threat. Here, they really showed, you know, particularly after some of the changes and stuff, how the Calculator is a major threat, it really, both before and after and stuff. And I think that this earned him a certain degree of viability. I still don't think he's an A-list villain, don't get me wrong. But he's certainly more in that direction than he was before, and it was more of a show-don't-tell kind of a thing here, which I respect. Now, I agree that the Birds of Prey were secondary characters here, and it is their book, but they were in the story, and again, I didn't feel like they were completely, you know, shoved aside for the sake of, you know, spotlighting the villain and stuff. But it would have been nice if they'd seen a little bit more use.
I mean, I didn't dislike it, I just didn't love it. And I, like I said, my key thing here is that I've loved this title in the past a lot more than I do now. It's an okay title. It's a 3, you know, and that's all it is to me right now. I mean, I read it, it's there.
For me, this was a 4. I thought it was a strong issue. It was good characterization and stuff. And, I mean, I can see where you're coming from. Don't get me wrong. And I'm not going to say this was the best of the run by any means. I think this has been an unusually strong title throughout its entire history, though. I mean, from when Chuck Dixon started the Birds of Prey through, you know, the last, you know, 125 issues, this is usually been a well above average series. So for you to say it's just down to average, I can see that. Personally, I really liked what they did with Kilgore in this issue. And I thought they did some cool kind of exploration of that character, more so than I think has been done pretty much anywhere else, I would say, up to and including the Flash series where that character started. Because that was a character, personally, I always thought was kind of lame. This one made him kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, that it did kind of come out of left field with him, though, on how they've treated him before.
Yeah, but that wasn't so much in this issue so much as how they just set him up earlier. I mean, Kilgore is a character that's just been all over the map and more towards the lame aspect of everything. And I think the way he was used here more as a supporting character and essentially almost a plot device or whatever, I thought worked and was probably one of the more interesting uses of the character, but I'll admit that's not saying a whole hell of a lot. One thing that did kind of stand out to me while I was going through this, and maybe I just haven't noticed it in other comics because I kind of ignore the ads, but the majority of the ads in this comic were DC House ads. I counted 10 of those, and there were 4 non-DC House ads. The back cover, the inside of the front and the back cover, and one other. And if the majority of the ads, you know, 10 compared to 4, is coming from in-house versus out-of-house, I gotta think their ad revenue's down. And if their ad revenue's down, that can't be, you know, boding well for, you know, are they going to be able to keep the prices where they're at or not. So I found that a little discouraging, but I don't know, because like I said, I haven't really paid attention to that aspect of, you know, how many of the ads are house ads or not, and I don't know if it's a new thing or not.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like there was an extremely high amount this issue compared to the other DC comics I've been reading, but that may just be an impression, not fact. This thing had 21 pages, $2.99. That works out to what, 14¼ cents per page?
Yep. I was surprised at the page count.
21 seems pretty much average.
That it dropped. Well, I mean, no more. They're more normally, they're 22. So this has one less page.
I'm curious where that page would have come from. It almost would have had to have been a house ad then, because, and I'm counting the DC Nation as part of that, although arguably it would have been a letters page before, but yeah.
And in general, these books have all had, you know, the standard $2.99 books have had 22 pages a story, and 21 is a page vanished.
Yeah, I'll agree with the math on that. To me, I've always been figuring it was 20 to 22, depending. So sometimes they get the extra page, sometimes they don't. But I don't know what's considered the industry standard these days. So I didn't see it being 21 as being a huge issue.
It just creeps that price per page up.
True.
A half a cent or so.
Well, and it'd be nice if they're going to be doing, you know, 10 pages of house ads and stuff, if they could do something that I felt was either a little bit more effective or entertaining. There were one or two of these where I couldn't figure out exactly what they were advertising. The one for the DC Universe survey early on was that way. So I really think whoever's putting together these in-house ads for them, and we've talked about this before, I don't think they're highly effective.
Well, you know, that's DC's model for advertising is cryptic. It's like, if you really want to dig at it, you can maybe glean what they're trying to get at. Although the DC Classics Library one is probably the clearest, but it was a little boring looking.
Well, there was that one, the Watchmen one, and one or two others where it was pretty clear what they were advertising and didn't seem... Like, the Spirit one I thought was effective. You know, it's obvious what it's pushing and stuff. But yeah, a couple of these, you know, just kind of pointless.
They managed to make Black Lightning look like Static. Maybe they're doing that on purpose.
You think he looks like Static there? You should see the first issue of that series.
I guess.
I was surprised by that. Actually, I didn't reread it. I re-skimmed that this week because I got a free replacement copy with this week's shipment of Black Lightning number 1, and I have no idea why. I don't know what was wrong with the original version and what was going on with that. Shall we move on to our Marvel pick?
Sure.
This is Dark Avengers number 1. This is a $3.99 book, and I had already seen a couple of these characters in a few other places, so I made a list before I started reading of who I thought these members were. A couple of cases I was not correct, which surprised me. What did you think of this?
I loved it. I've kind of gone on record as saying I would have to love a book and have it be a 5 out of 5 in order for me to pay $3.99 for a standard length book. And next issue, Dark Avengers, is, I believe, going to be $3.99 for a standard length book. And I will get it because I thought this was really good and I gave it a 5 out of 5. I, you know, other than Tommy Lee Osborne here, a little funny that Norman Osborn looks, to me, exactly like Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, they've been doing that in the Thunderbolts for ages.
Yeah, it's at least better than that one where they made Namor look like some kind of chunky hobo. This one is at least within character. That was the we just did that.
It was the Dark Rain one shot.
Yeah, Dark Rain one shot. No, I thought that was very effective how they are doing sort of a Thunderbolts, the original Thunderbolts, not the, you know, like right out in the open, yeah, psychotic killer version of Thunderbolts that are running around now, but, you know, bad guys dressed up as heroes kind of thing. Good job. I like how Osborn took over Avengers Tower. I think I missed, if they indeed revealed it, who Hawkeye is.
They allude to it with one of the people getting recruited, but they don't flat out say who it is. But I think it's pretty obvious.
Okay. I'm kind of like figuring that that's who it is. But no, I liked it. I liked like what they did with Venom. I like what they did with Moonstone.
I had a bit of a different reaction to the book. I thought this was very reminiscent of the classic Thunderbolts, which I had kind of expected. An aspect or two of kind of the setting of the scenes for what's going to happen in future issues reminded me of early issues of the Busiek Perez run of Avengers. And between both of those kind of aspects, the whole thing had a little bit, not of a been there, done that, but I've seen aspects of this before kind of vibe to it. Going in, I've had a pretty good idea who at least the characters on the cover were going to be. And on the cover, you see, you know, in shadowy things, the Iron Patriot, the Spider-Man looking guy, the Hawkeye, you know, Wolverine and Ms. Marvel, or at least that's who it looks like. The only one I had guessed wrong was Ms. Marvel. The way they went with that, I thought was an interesting choice and kind of fits kind of the Thunderbolts 2.0 kind of a thing. But, you know, the opening splash, you know, a page or two into this is the classic, you know, announcement of the Avengers lineup, and everything else is kind of flashbacks, and they keep going back to that shot of the Avengers lineup and stuff, and it felt like, well, certainly some things happened in this issue, it felt like too much of it was just, here's who the roster of characters is going to be, and I didn't feel that the story really moved forward anywhere. This was definitely a setup issue, and that's fine. It's a number one. It set things up acceptably. They gave a couple of good answers, because as soon as I realized a couple of these characters were on the team, it's like, Ares, why is he there? They gave a good answer. Fits the character, I'm happy. Why is Sentry on the team? They gave a lame answer, but he's a lame character, so I guess I really shouldn't have expected anything beyond that. The Captain Marvel one didn't really make any sense as to why that character's on the team. With Ms. Marvel, they're kind of conveniently ignoring another character going around in that costume, but c'est la vie. And with Venom, the whole change in the look for the character was kind of a contrived plot device to me. And that was the one that, out of all the others where they're kind of doing this impersonation thing, just didn't work as well as I would have liked it to for me. And then when they bring in the Ghost later in the issue, he looks way different than I remember him looking. I mean, he looks almost like a skinny, skeletal, robotic-looking thing. And, I mean, I know I usually think of him in terms of, you know, how he showed up back in the 80s and 90s and stuff, but totally different look to the character. And, I mean, we know that we've got the Iron Patriot here, a guy in, you know, an Iron Man-type suit of armor. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and I say that knowing that I'm not wrong. Didn't Tony fight a couple of armor wars and melt down a ton of old armor to prevent people from getting hands on some of his old armor? So there was an aspect in here that just didn't work for me there. Certainly, I think it's not a bad book. There's some heavy use of shadows and stuff that made the art a little not to my liking. It's not bad art, but, you know, I'm of the school of thought that, you know, if you're going to light the scene, light the scene. To me, this was a 3. It came close to being a 4 if there had either been a little bit more plot to it, if there'd been, you know, the art had been a little more to my liking, or I don't know. It was more or less what I was expecting out of it and didn't really surprise me in too many ways and certainly didn't make me think, wow, this is a brilliant book. Certainly not a horrible book, but, you know, do we need yet another Avengers title is one of the questions I've got right now. And this is as much another Thunderbolts book as another Avengers book.
Well, seeing as I dropped Thunderbolts and I dropped New Avengers, I don't need another Avengers book. I'm going to read this Avengers book, The Mighty Avengers.
Fair enough.
I think we're starting to see your DC leanings versus my Marvel leanings more and more as you're cutting back, though.
Keep in mind that I'm not just cutting back slightly, I'm cutting back majorly. So, you know, this is an area that, were budget not a concern, sure, I would keep getting this. I'm curious where they're going to go with it and if it's going to have a better payoff than some of the earlier Thunderbolts stuff. Now, mind you, I thought the first issue of Thunderbolts, because I didn't see the swerve coming at the end, blew me away. Here, they worked at it from the other angle and it wasn't as good. I would have liked to have seen how Kurt Busiek would have handled this same sort of a story. Because again, it's so similar to some of the stuff he's done on Thunderbolts and stuff like that before.
I guess this helps by me being less able to just anticipate everything Bendis does than you are, because you obviously, you're saying that you saw everything coming that came. I didn't. I mean, I haven't given it a whole lot of thought, though. You know, it's just, I picked up the book, I started reading it, and I said, oh, that's kind of cool. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, I like that. I hadn't thought of that. You know, and it's just, I went through it, and, you know, as each thing happened, it wasn't like I had predicted every single thing that happened, as, you know, you're kind of going through and saying, oh, yeah, you know, I kind of saw that all coming. And you know. So I just came at it maybe differently, and that's why I liked it more.
No, that's fair, but I mean, I don't think I gave it tons and tons of thought either. It's I pull up the cover before reading it, and it's like, oh, we got a Wolverine looking character. Who could fill in for that kind of a thing? You know, again, the only one I didn't really see coming was the Ms. Marvel one. That, again, was a surprise, and it makes sense, but kind of flies in the face of one or two other things that's been going on lately, but par for the course these days, I guess. I was kind of surprised how many ads were in this book, too. Now, granted, it's a bigger book, so of course there's going to be more ads. There were 8 non-Marvel ads, and I'm counting the Hulk versus DVD in that category, and there were 11 pages, which essentially amounted to in-house ads, although only 2 were really in-house ads proper, and that was for Thunderbolts and Daredevil. And the Thunderbolts one makes sense, but the Daredevil one, I'm sure they're just putting everywhere. And I'm counting the 8-page Secret Warriors preview and the recap page as kind of, you know, pages of in-house ad, which technically they're kind of not, but they are, you know what I mean. But there were 32 pages of story here, which I think they needed, and certainly helped further justify the $3.99 price point.
I was actually quite pleased at that, too, because I was expecting, you know, if par for the course, you know, if they jacked the price up on the first issue, that it would be a 22-page story with just that kind of house ad for Secret Warriors or something, padding out the page count. And the fact that they actually made the main story longer was, I appreciated that.
Yeah, same here. I would have been very unhappy if I'd hit the staple and a to be continued or whatever.
I'm curious how much Marvel charges for an ad. Because I just look at this and it's like, are they giving Midtown Comics some kind of a deal? Because they give people at Marvel Comics, or I don't know what. I mean, how does Midtown Comics, I mean, they're not like a huge online force or anything.
No, but they're one of the major stores in New York City, and that's got a huge population base to draw from, so it may do very well. I don't know. But yes, they do advertise quite heavily.
I'm just saying, it's like, for them putting an ad in, I'm just wondering how much it must cost for it to justify them putting a full-page ad in a Marvel comic book.
Yeah. Well, because I've seen ads for them elsewhere, too, and they seem to have a fairly aggressive approach for a comic store to placing ads and stuff. So presumably they see the benefit from it. But, you know, it's very different to see a comic store, which may have, you know, what, 2 or 3 locations or whatever, compared to, you know, like on the back cover, we've got Honda, much bigger company.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm talking. I mean, usually, just kind of struck me. I mean, I see Xbox or Netflix or, you know, things like this. And even if it was like a chain that had a huge web presence, you know, like Mile High or, you know, something like that, or they're going national with it. But here we've got, you know, they got 2 locations. Now, they do say, you know, hey, see our exclusive discounts, subscribe to our newsletter. But it's not like they're really pushing in this ad that they have a subscription service that they're willing to, you know, send comics to people wherever. Just a point of curiosity to me, though.
Nope, I agree with that. This worked out to about 12.5 cents a page for the story, which, given you also get the 8-page Secret Warriors preview, not a bad deal. Shall we move on to our other book for the week?
Sure.
Now, this time we decided to venture a little further afield than we normally do. This is a title neither of us have picked up and read before. That's Betty and Veronica Spectacular, number 87, and this is, of course, from Archie Comics. And the first thing I'm noticing on the cover, which was not on either the Marvel or DC, this actually has approved by the Comics Code Authority. Haven't seen one of those little stamps in a while.
Yeah, you know, the Comics Code Authority frowns on ripping people's arms off and then beating them to death with it.
Can't say that I blame them. I frown on that, too. And boy, was I surprised in this issue when that happened. No, I'm just kidding.
I was drawn to this from previews, just from this cover image. It intrigued me. You have Betty and Veronica in their spy outfits, and it's the all-out action issue. So let's give it a try. We've got some people on the forum always talking about it, and people get it for their kids. And, you know, Archie has been there. I mean, I've read Archie's when I was a kid, but I haven't picked up and read an Archie comic in 20, 25 years. But I still know who all the main characters are in Archie and kind of know the general, you know, storyline. So I figure, okay, let's pick this one up and take it a read and see what we think. And I thought it was a decent story. I mean, you got, you know, it's relatively linear, non-complicated. You know, you got some action, interplay. One thing I didn't quite like was that when they ended, they kind of ended sort of abruptly about halfway into the issue, and then kind of like stay tuned, the end, watch for more adventures of Agents B and V in upcoming issues of Archie Comics. And it doesn't kind of tell you where or when. Yeah, it just seems like, yeah, you know, if somebody is intrigued by this particular storyline, you might want to let them know where they can get more of it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one thing it's worth noting is the structure of this. It's not a full page story and a you know, letter page kind of equivalent. They've got this one story that is like 12 pages, followed by a couple of shorter features, which one's a movie quiz, one's on some of the top secret gadgets, one on some of the secrets of the Archie gang, a 2-page thing on undercover fashion or whatever. So it's a, I don't say a magazine format, but for the back half it kind of sort of is. And the story, the lead story in this, really the only story in this, is like I said 12 pages. It was a little more, I don't say cartoony than what I thought the typical Archie style was, but I don't know, the art seemed a little bit different than I was expecting in one or two places.
In the main story or elsewhere?
In the main story.
Because it kind of tracked along pretty much how I don't know, I don't have crystal clarity of memory, but I mean, this is relatively similar to the style that I'm used to seeing for Archie, so it didn't seem...
It's similar, yeah, but go to like the fourth page of the story where they're getting the various devices and stuff. And the bottom left panel where they're getting the jetpack sneakers, Veronica just doesn't look good. You know, there's something about the lips, the face, same with the panel right above that. I don't know. It's a simplified enough style that it's not like it's hideously off model or anything like that. But it's got enough of a difference that it just kind of stood out, saying it was noticeable. Not bad, but just a little different than I was expecting. There were a ton of characters in this storyline. I was surprised by that. And there were a couple which I didn't think were introduced as well as I would have liked. And a few that, I mean, it's the whole Archie gang. But really, once you get past the core characters, there are a couple of these I just had no clue who were. But fun story. It was good. It was, I don't want to say shallow, I don't want to say light, but it's simplified. And again, this is, I think, aiming towards a younger readership than most comics, and I think this is highly appropriate for that. I wasn't offended by the story, but it wasn't something that left me thinking, oh wow, there was such great depth and stuff. But they're not shooting for that either. So, and this was a what-if kind of a story. What if Betty and Veronica were secret agents? And it did that decently. The 2-page fashion spread in the middle, completely worthless to me. Did nothing for me. Just pin-up stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that, but...
Well, I mean, I read this in a certain different way than I normally read a comic book, and that is, I went into this with the understanding that I am about as far from the target demographic from this comic as you can pretty much get. I mean, I'm going to guess that this is targeting 8 to 13-year-old girls, maybe?
Probably. I'm curious what they consider their target audience to be, and yes, we are not part of it. I know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of like gave them a buy on a lot of these things, you know, like the fashion pages and stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay.
Well, let me put it this way. As worthless as I thought these two fashion pages were, I liked them better than the equivalent pages in the Hellcat series.
Okay, I didn't read the Hellcat series, so I'll have to believe it.
Or maybe it was the Hellcat in the Marvel Comics Presents.
Oh yeah, in the Marvel Comic Presents. Yeah, I remember that. Yes, I agree with you there.
You know, the rest of the stuff, the secrets of the gang, I thought that was fine. It was interesting.
And again, I think that that's really targeting in at the demographic. I think that's the kind of stuff that they want to get.
Yeah. I did not know Jughead was allergic to lima beans. Didn't really care, but I'm glad to know that.
There's a trivia question for you.
The two-page action movie quiz was interesting. The top-secret gadgets was not bad. And these are shorter features. Most of these are either 2 or 5 pages or whatever. And it does give it a feel that there's a decent amount of content in here. Now, the one thing, there are a couple of things about this just from a production standpoint that I noticed that I think are worth talking about briefly. One, this is more of an old school style of comic physically, by which I mean it is on newsprint. It's got a simpler color scheme, although they have some gradients and stuff like that. So I guess the colors aren't as simplified as I was thinking at first. But certainly they're not going for the uber glossy paper and spending a ton on those aspects of production. But the other thing I noticed that I thought was very different from, and I'm going to compare it more to the DC book that we just talked about, Birds of Prey, was the nature of the ads. There were only 2 ads that were not for Archie. There was the Dragon Ball Origins one on the inside front cover and the Aaron Stone series on the Disney thing on the back cover. Everything else was in-house ads. Now, there were only 6 of them, but the nature of them was what got me. They had a subscription form if you want to subscribe to the various comics, complete with a fill this out, send it in, and we'll send copies to you. They had one for the various graphic novels they've done, their trade paperbacks, essentially. All of them were geared towards give this to your parents, fill this out, and we'll send you more comics kind of a thing. There was a very clear call to action, a very clear, here's what we're advertising, here's what it's going to cost you, here's how to go get it.
I really liked the fact that they have shipping and handling included on, I don't know if you noticed that or not.
No, I hadn't, but I do think that's good.
Like on the graphic novels. And I could actually get, like they've got like the Archie Love Showdown. It's like, 48 pages. It's $4.95, but shipping's included. So it's not like it's $4.95 and then you're going to pay another $4.95 for shipping or something. Price is the price.
Yeah. But again, gearing it towards a, if somebody's reading this and just has to have more, there's an unbelievably clear way for them to do that here. And I thought that was really smart. And I've got to think that's part of what helps their subscription numbers and whatnot do fairly well. Although the question is, how well are their subscription numbers doing? And we can actually answer that, because the other thing that I particularly enjoyed about this issue is it had, just by sheer luck, the statement of ownership for this title. And I tried to compare that to how it's doing through Diamond. I say try, because Archie books typically don't do well through Diamond. Again, they're hitting a different demographic than most of us who are hitting the comic stores every Wednesday, or the online equivalents thereof.
And I do notice that the majority of comic shops I go into don't have any Archie comics in them.
Or if they do, they've got 1 or 2 segregated off of, if you've brought your kids, show them this rack.
Right.
Kind of a thing. It's definitely for a different demographic. But the last time the Betty and Veronica Spectacular made the top 300 list was February 2007, with issue 77 selling an estimated 1,705 units. And because of, increased production by Marvel, DC, and events and stuff like that, sales of that magnitude normally don't make it on the list these days. The issue that the actual numbers for the statement of ownership were for are for issue 84. That shipped on July 23rd, 2008. It did not make the top 300 list, and that list bottomed out at 4,255 units. So it did somewhere, below that.
Through Diamond, yet here it's saying that, it was selling considerably more than that, so.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, is I was trying to figure out what percentage of their sales was through Diamond and what is not, and we can't do that because we don't have the Diamond side of that for this issue. It's interesting because they do their statement of ownership a little bit differently than some of the other publishers, and for their total distribution on this, they have the numbers at, 9,464 units for issue 84. So, obviously well under half of that could have gone through Diamond. But their print run is about 3 times that. And they kind of do some funny stuff with what they consider total distribution versus, total copies, and therefore their percentage distributed is kind of weird. So, it was good to have this information. I found it very enlightening. Because basically, even the total copies of this is only in the 25,000 to 27,000 range. So it's not like these are doing the hundreds of thousands that some people assume that Archie might be doing in the mainstream. I just wanted to kind of toss that out there. Counting all of the feature pages, because some of them aren't really story pages, but everything that's content other than the table of contents, you got 26 pages. It's a 225 book that works out to a little bit over 11.5 cents per page, which, you know, is a fairly good deal. So I thought this was entertaining, but, you know, light reading.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm not going to run out and throw it on my pull list or anything, but, I mean, if I had a daughter and she was, you know, probably even anywhere from 6 or 7 on up, I think this would be a great book, you know, to get them into comics.
Yeah.
And that's what they're targeting. So, I mean, as what it is, I mean, I give it a 4, and that's looking at it on the, you know, that's me looking at it as value that it's delivering to its target demographic.
I gave it a 3, and that was me looking at it in terms of more just what I thought of it. I'm sure people in the target audience would indeed probably rate it higher. I thought it was a perfectly fine issue. You know, it did what it set out to do. It told a decent story, had some other stuff. It's something that if I had to read it each and every, actually every other month, because it comes up bi-monthly, wouldn't really object to, but wouldn't be top of my stack either. But it's perfectly respectable, and I think it's a good all-ages title. I didn't think it was overly dumbed down and insulting by any stretch of the imagination. So I think they're doing a good job there.
I didn't find it dumbed down at all, as a matter of fact, and that's the one thing that I will give them credit for versus like a Marvel Adventures book, you know. Recently, any Marvel Adventures book I've read, I feel, are dumbed down and just somewhat condescending. This, I didn't get that feeling from.
Yeah, agreed. This is well done.
So, did anything else stand out this week?
I read a ton of stuff. One of the things that stands out, and not really in a good way, was that Secret Invasion Home Invasion trade paperback.
I have not read that yet, but I kind of flipped through it and the art looked pretty bad.
The art looked pretty bad. I'm pretty sure it was serialized on a monthly basis because it kind of sort of follows the timeline almost of Secret Invasion.
Yeah, it is. It was on the web.
Well, I knew it was on the web, but I wasn't sure how many installments it was and how, you know, what the time frame of the serialization was. And it seemed to go more or less in terms of each issue of Secret Invasion, more or less. So it kind of underscores the odd timeline that series has that you don't really notice when there's a month or so between issues, but when you read the whole thing kind of in a condensed format, you know, you get the, oh, suddenly fights break out here, then another one here, and then suddenly Nick Fury's here, oh, this guy's here, you know, kind of a haphazard nature to it. I didn't think they did a really good job doing the somebody's brother turns out to be an alien thing. I was disappointed by it. It's one that I think people can safely skip. Like Doctor Who Forgotten, that was the final issue of that. I enjoyed that miniseries. Read the Final Crisis Superman Beyond number 2 and felt more or less the same way about that as I felt about the first one. I wish they would have had a non-3D version of it. That stuff just gives me a headache.
I skipped that one after we read the first one. The way I felt about number 1, I didn't come back for number 2. Well, it didn't hurt that it was like 6 or 7 months in between them either.
It was only about 4, but it was way the hell too long.
Felt like 6 or 7. It's far enough that I had not ordered number 2 yet when number 1 was in my hands and I was reading it. So I could make the decision of, ooh, I guess I won't get the second one because this first one was awful.
Yeah, that was a mistake on their part. One that I was very disappointed with was the Justice League of America came out with different contents than what they had solicited for. Supposed to be a Faces of Evil with Dr. Light, and instead we got Starbreaker. And it felt like not so much an inventory story so much as a, oh crap, we're not going to have what we need on time. Oh, Len Wein's walking down the hall. Hey, Len, could you write something for us tonight so we can have somebody draw it tomorrow and slam it out the next day? It just felt rushed. It felt forced. It felt like it wasn't anybody's best work. And it kind of killed the momentum that the story and the title had going.
I guess I didn't mind it that much. I know a lot of people were railing about it on the forum. But I really didn't like the last couple of issues that much, so it's not like it threw a giant... I know you liked the Milestone issues a lot more than I did, so I can see where you thought that it threw the brakes on. For me, it was just another issue.
It had nothing to do with the storyline in progress, regardless of what you think of the storyline, you know what I mean? It was a really bad time for filling issue.
Yeah, they kind of tied it in at the end, I thought. I didn't mind it. It was, again, it was an okay issue. It wasn't anything, I didn't love it. I didn't have it into me to despise it as much as some people have gone on record as despising it.
Well, and I can see that, but I mean, it was a recap of previous stories, and there was something about the art, and the only way I can really phrase it is it's like you're face to face with somebody and they just won't look you in the eye. I had that feeling with the art. Like it was aiming to the left of me or to the right of me, but not towards me or something. It was a little disconcerting. Flip side, I read the Star Trek Countdown. I had gotten that first issue and was a little surprised by the nature of the story, but really liked that, and it does have me curious about both the remainder of that series and the upcoming movie.
Did you like anything other than Star Trek?
I liked a lot of it. The Green Lantern stuff was good. Really curious where they're going with some of that. And the one question I've got on this, just as a general Green Lantern question, because I can't remember. I know that way back in the day, Guy had Sinestro's ring at one point. Has Hal ever worn a yellow ring? I'm thinking he did at some point. I just can't remember when. I was curious about that.
I am not recalling.
I thought Mighty Avengers was good, but not great. This is another one where it's, okay, let's get the new lineup. I'm enjoying what they're doing with the Supergirl and the whole new Krypton stuff. The Superman Batman annual was actually a lot better than I was afraid it was going to be. I like the composite Superman, but I like the Legion version of it better. This was a very different approach to the character, and actually worked a lot better than I had thought it would. So I enjoyed that. And, oh, that's the other one I want to talk about. X-Factor. This is issue 39. 39 is a major turning point for the series, and I say that only in so much as Peter David, starting with this issue, has requested people not tell anything about the story to other people, so don't spoil it, don't ruin it. He's very clear up front on that on the recap page. I respect that. But I say this is a turning point in so much as he is, over the course of this year, starting with this issue, his goal is to triple the sales of this title. I wish him the best of luck. I think he's off to a good start. I think he's a talented writer. I don't know if anyone can triple the sales of any book these days, by and large. But man, it's going to be fun to watch him try. There was an aspect about the interview he gave, I think it was on Newsarama, but I could be wrong on that, where he was talking about some of this and the, you know, wanting to triple the sales and stuff, that almost reeked of the, well, I've been holding back before, but now all bets are off. He didn't say that, he didn't mean that, but it kind of had that vibe to it, you know, of now he's getting serious and he's gonna, you know, pull out all the stops. And I certainly don't think he's any sort of a lazy writer or whatever. He's usually a very solid writer, and when he's on his A game, man, nothing can stop him. He can be a brilliant writer at times, and I'm looking forward to seeing that out of him this year. So if you haven't read X-Factor 39, go read X-Factor 39. Tell people nothing about it, let them read it, and discover the story for themselves.
I liked it.
I thought it was great.
X-Factor's kind of a quirky book. I mean, it's the kind of book that you're either going to like it or you're not going to like it, and it's not something that I can see droves of standard superhero comic fans flocking to.
Tripling the sales will put it near the top of the list, and I can't see that happening.
Yeah.
Regardless of the contents of the book. You know, because like you said, it's a quirky enough thing.
Well, particularly given the kind of book that it is.
Well, it's kind of an off-on-the-side X-book. It's got kind of that neither fish nor fowl. It's not a core X-book, but it's not an X-book. So he's got his work cut out for him, but should be fun to watch. Oh, other thing I wanted to talk about, nearly forgot. After our year-in-review episode, there was a comment on the forum, and it basically was along the lines of, you know, we had forgotten who somebody was and what he had done over the course of the year when going through the people's best of the year type stuff. And somebody was like, oh, how could you forget how this guy did this, that, or the other? And fair question. I think that's a good question, because this was, who was this artist that they were talking about? This guy on Guardians of the Galaxy.
Pelletier?
Yes. Yeah, that's the one. So, I mean, good book, good art, people were liking and stuff, and couldn't remember the name. So, with the help of Comic Book DB, and thank you guys at Comic Book DB for putting together such a wonderful resource, I took my list of what I got this week, and I got 39 comics, one toy, one trade. Out of those 39 comics, I got the writer, the penciler, the inkers, the colors, the letterers, the editors, the cover artists for all of them, except for the Betty and Veronica, the Knights of the Dinner Table, Secret Invasion Invasion, Home Invasion trade paperback, and the creative team for Trinity or Wolverine First Class. But basically, everything they had data for, I pulled into a spreadsheet, filtered it down to unique names for each category. And just to give you an idea of how many names, if I were to actually pay attention and really study the credits, which admittedly I do not do, how many names I would have encountered just in this week's comics. 37 writers, 38 artists, 42 inkers, 36 colorists, 20 letterers, 34 editors, which was higher than I expected, but in some cases they listed everybody up the food chain, and 48 cover artists. Well, the question is, okay, some of these are going to be in multiple columns. How many unique names is that? 221 for 1 week's comics. Over the course of the year, I can only guess how staggering long of a list this would be. Obviously, some of these columns, like the editors, probably wouldn't grow radically, but a few of the others, like the writers, the artists, the inkers, and stuff, probably would. So, that's how come I can't remember names. There's just too damn many of them. And some of them are god-awful hard to pronounce. But, yeah. So, I just thought I'd toss that out there, too. Anything else? We done.
Well, I will point out that I thought Squadron Supreme number 7 was really good.
I thought it was good, but the part that got me is where I think they're going with this makes sense for Squadron Supreme, because Squadron Supreme has done it before, if you know what I mean. It's certainly going to be a different take, whatever, but it's one where enough of the new characters that Chaykin's introduced feel like knockoff Avengers, combined with the Squadron Supreme kind of being knockoff Justice Leaguers, that it's got a little bit more of a derivative feel than I like. That having been said, I also think it's some of Chaykin's best work in ages. Certainly a night and day difference.
Join us next week when we discuss Final Crisis number 7 from DC, X-Men Worlds Apart number 4 from Marvel, and Dragon Prince number 4 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.